that record was not supposed to be a hit. But it became a hit. And it was the start of the Vinyl Highway. To explain about the Vinyl Highway, I have on the phone with me Dee Dee Phelps of the duo of Dick and Dee Dee. Welcome to the show, Dee Dee.
Thank you, Ronnie. It's really great to be on the show today.
This is such a pleasure. I have your book called Vinyl Highway, Singing as Dick and Dee Dee. I read it from cover to cover, so you can give me a surprise quiz anytime you want.
Okay.
It is a memoir. What is a memoir?
Well, a memoir is a period of time. You're writing about a very specific period of time, whereas an autobiography would be your whole life. So basically, the Vinyl Highway is about the 60s, and which was the career of Dick and Dee Dee and Dick and myself. We started in 61, and we ended the career at the end of the 60s, so it basically was a decade there.
So in other words, a memoir cover is just a small portion of one's life.
Yes, it could even be, some people write a memoir about a day or a week. It's not a whole life, it's a portion.
Or a minute.
Or a minute, yes. Interestingly enough, this book covers 10 years. It took me 4.5 years to write it, so it almost took me half of the time I was singing to write about the experience.
The book, as I say, is called Vinyl Highway, written by Dee Dee Phelps, and it's all about Dick and Dee Dee, the singing career of Dick and Dee Dee. It's not just about Dick and Dee Dee, though. It's also about the music business as it was during the 10 years that you experienced it. It's a very honest portrayal of events. And it's the good, the bad, and the in-between.
Yes, I think so.
A little bit of everything. My name is Ronnie Allen, and for the next hour, the subject is going to be Dick and Dee Dee, the book Vinyl Highway. And, of course, we're going to be playing the greatest hits that Dick and Dee Dee had, leading off with The Mountains High. But, as I said at the outset, The Mountains High was not supposed to be the hit.
Dick and I were in our teens when we were reacquainted, when we were both working in a candy store, actually, for a Christmas job in college. And we started working together songwriting because I had written some lyrics, and he told me he had melodies that he wrote. And I didn't know anybody that wrote songs at that point in my life, and he didn't either. So as we were talking it over, we were astonished to find out that each of us were songwriters. So we got together, and oddly enough, the song I'd written, which was a very beautiful ballad called I Want Someone, he was able to put it to one of his melodies as if they'd been written at the same time. The actual phrasing fit all of the music in a very remarkable way. So he said, what do you think of this? And he started singing his melody with my words, and I listened to it through a few times, and then I picked up a harmony, and I started singing along with him. So he turned on his tape recorder, and we recorded the two voices, and then he played it back another time, and I heard another harmony. I hear harmonies all the time.
Right.
So I sang a parallel third, which was a third higher than my first harmony, and not to be best of there, Dick decided to sing an octave higher in falsetto. So we basically created what became the Dick and Dee Dee sound. Well, when we got through singing it, we just looked at each other. We went, what was that? I was like, what? This amazing sound had come out. So Dick decided he was going to show some songs he'd written to some producers he'd met, and he wanted to include a tape of this one song that we'd done together. So we went to a recording studio at 6 in the morning in Hollywood because it was cheaper then. We were in college. We didn't have a lot of funds. We recorded both voices on two different tracks with his piano plunking it out, and he put it on this tape and went to see the producers.
So the wheels were turning.
Well, they loved this song, and they asked us to come into a major studio. It was Gold Star in Hollywood. And I had never recorded in my life. I had never sung any song other than I Want Someone with Dick, and only had practiced it. I think we maybe practiced one more time before the actual session. So I didn't know what to expect, but I was very nervous. But we went into this huge studio, and here they had an entire orchestra because everything had to be live. We're talking about mono folks, you know, the Phil Spector days and before.
Yes.
Mono and four tracks. So everything was live. There were strings, and they went all out with a full orchestra on this beautiful song. And as they started to play the music, we were in a little control booth and was separated for isolation purposes for sound. And we started singing along with this beautiful music, and I just thought, oh, this is so beautiful. I couldn't imagine all this being added to this little song that Dick and I wrote together, these beautiful strings, and it was just
right.
A wonderful experience. Well, after that was over, about a week or two went by, Dick called and said they want to release it, but we have to have a back side. Obviously, records have two sides. He had a few lyrics to The Mountains High. We sort of worked on them a little bit. And then we quickly learned our parts on that one. And they kept saying, don't put any energy into this. It's just going to be the B-side. We really want to release this quickly because we think this ballad is beautiful and will really do well, but it needs to come out right away. So we went to this time, our little studio, instead of being Gold Star, was a small engineer's studio over his garage in Hollywood, where he lived at his house. And we went up there, and all this padding was coming out of the walls, and there was chicken wire holding it up, and but place looked a little run down, shall we say. And instead of an orchestra, we had four musicians, and this young man was playing drums, and we were isolated from the control booth there, this little room where our producers were crowded in with a sound engineer. And they said, let's run it through. So we started singing along with the musicians, and then they recorded it. We heard it back, and it just sounded so strange. The machine was acting up, and at times it would record too slowly, and at times it would record too fast. And the echo was bouncing off of the walls, and it was just chaos. And the drummer was getting kind of bent out of shape. He was saying, oh, man, you know, my drums sound like I'm in a tin can. What are you doing to me? But anyway, they kept laughing and turning dials, you know, and we were getting more and more concerned, you know. Dick's face was getting beet red. And I was thinking, I don't know, well, at least it's a B-side, you know, no one's ever going to hear it anyway. So finally, after a very short time, maybe an hour or so, hour and a half, whatever, they said, okay, we've got it, you're fine, you can go now. They wouldn't even let us hear it. They just said, don't worry, we've got it here. We got it in the can. So off we went. Well, that summer I was going for my final vacation with my family. You know, there's always one final vacation that's made, usually under protest when you're in your teens before you figure out that you're old enough to not go on family vacations anymore.
Right.
This was sort of my last hurrah. We were driving up from Los Angeles up to Seattle, Washington, to go to a farm up there through my dad's work. And we were in the car, and I was the oldest. I have two sisters, and I was the oldest one. So I would always commandeer the radio. And it would have to be top 40, you know, of course, and pretty
proud
at that. My dad was a little hard of hearing, so he and I were good to sit in front because I blessed the radio, and he wouldn't hear it. And in fact, it didn't bother them that much because they were further away. We were up near the San Francisco Bay Area, and we're sailing along, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere comes The Mountains High is being played on the radio. Well, I was totally startled. I let out this yell. My dad was so startled, he swung the wheel to the right, and we sort of floated off the road, bounced over some boulders. Finally, he made it back onto the road, and then he wasn't real happy, to say the least. He looked at me, and he said, what is that all about? And I said, well, I said, two things. I said, first of all, that's our record. I was so excited, but I said, but it's the wrong size. Why are they playing that thing? I couldn't even hear it clearly. I didn't know if it was good or bad or what, you know. Actually, Dick had brought over a copy before we went on this trip, and he came over as if he was holding a gold nugget. I mean, he was so cautiously handed me this record. And I looked at it, and I said, wait a minute. And said, it says Dick and Dee Dee, but my name's Mary.
Ah.
He said, oh, don't worry about it. You'll get used to it. He said, they just changed it. They thought it'd sound better. So he left. I raced in. I put on I Want Someone on the record player. And I listened to it, and I said, oh, it's beautiful. I love it. It came out really great. It sounds so great. I turned over to The Mountains High side. I played about a quarter of it, and I said, oh, this is the most horrible thing I've ever heard. I couldn't even hear the rest of it. I said, thank goodness no one will hear this.
Quite honestly, it had kind of a primitive type of a sound. It was not polished by any means.
It wasn't. So when I heard it, of course, coming over the airwaves, I was completely shocked. And then we kept hearing it over and over and over as we're driving. The San Francisco Bay Area was playing it a lot, and that broadcasting band went a long ways. I must have heard it, I don't know, 17, 20 times or something, each time getting more and more concerned.
Yeah. Well, I have to backtrack and just ask you a couple of questions. Now, obviously, it was released on some small label, right?
Yes, called Llama Records, a little blue label. Sometimes people email me and they'll say, you know what, I've got the Llama version, which is really great.
L-A-M-A, but in other words, instead of two L's, it's just one L?
Just one L, right.
Just one L. Were the Wilder Brothers involved in the Mountains High?
Oh, yes, they were involved in everything we did. They were producers, and they were also a Vegas lounge act themselves.
Okay,
they were three brothers.
So they were the ones that actually produced both sessions.
That's right, and also they formed a partnership between the three brothers and Don Walkie, who was a well-known arranger.
Very well-known.
And the reason he was playing the Mountains High, this disc jockey, he happened to be Bob Mitchell on KYA. Bob just wasn't paying any attention. He went to put on I Want Someone. He was talking to somebody over his shoulder, and he just slapped the wrong side down.
Well.
And the phone lines lit up, and they rang for the next half hour. That's why I heard it so much on the radio. They made it a discovery, and it went from discovery to number one in just a very short time, a couple of weeks.
And then eventually Liberty Records picked it up.
Right.
And the rest, as they say, is history. Why don't we listen to the record right now? This is Dick and Dee Dee and The Mountains High. We pretty much covered chapter one, Little Mary's on the Radio. And at this rate, we're going to have a six-hour show here because there's 36 chapters here. But actually, chapter one is a very important chapter. My understanding was that even though it says Dick St. John on the record as the composer of the song, you had something to do with the writing of it as well.
Yes. When we worked together, when I went over there the first time and I had the words to I Want Someone, and Dick came up with a melody, we were sort of forming a partnership. We were writing it together and so forth. And so when he called up and said we need a B-side, I presumed we would be working again and coming up with something. Unless someone had something totally written, that would be another matter.
Right.
But I went over there. Dick did have some words to The Mountains High. He had maybe the first verse and a couple lines of the bridge, sort of like that. He didn't really know where to go with it, and so we started coming up with things that would rhyme, certain lines. We worked it out. We worked out other lyrics. We put together when it should go into the bridge, how we should come back to repeat the first verse again at the end, and we basically created the song together. It wasn't until after the recording session, we were driving home, he was driving me in his car, that he announced that he was going to take the writing credit on The Mountains High. I was shocked. I just thought, whoa, you know? I mean, I did believe that I had participated at least 50% or so. And so I told him that, and he started getting more and more agitated. And then finally, he just slammed on the brakes really hard, and I kind of fell forward, and I hit my wrist on the dashboard, which was rather painful. And so I got out of the car. It was at my house, and I slammed the door and went into the house. I didn't talk to him for a while. But after that, you know, I kind of let go of it. A friend of mine told me, they said, you know what? You can do two things. You can never talk to him again and break up this whole thing, and you'll be disappointing a lot of people who put their time and energy into recording this thing. You don't know what's going to happen. Or you can go on with this and see what happens. And he said 50% of nothing is still nothing, but 100% of something is something. You know what I'm saying? It's like, yeah. If something happens with this, there'll be other opportunities, was basically what he was telling me.
But you also saw it as the B-side of the record anyway. So maybe that's...
Oh, yes, that's right.
Maybe sure. That's part of the reason why you kind of just backed off a little bit and you said,
sure.
Little did you know.
Right.
At any rate, The Mountains High got to number two on the chart. We should point out that the record that kept it out of the number one spot happened to be on the same record label, Liberty Records. And so a Liberty record kept out a Liberty record. That's the way it happened. Bobby V, Take Good Care of My Baby.
Yeah, that was a great song. It was a wonderful song, yeah.
The other thing about The Mountains High is that drumming, maybe it's not a work of art, but that drumming is very, very, it's kind of catchy. It kind of grows on you, actually.
It's a very unique drum pattern, and additionally, it was mic'd in such a way, and probably was an accident, I don't know, but among all these strange sound things that were going on, but it really, it's very echoey, and it has a lot of reverb on it, and so that combination of that pattern plus the echo really made it stand out.
And I think that what made it work is probably the drummer was probably getting so annoyed with the session, he was banging, I think he was banging harder, wanted to get it over with. Is that possible?
Oh, I think you got it, that's it.
I think I hit the nail on the head. Like it or not, you became Dick and Dee Dee. You had that record, which made it a little bit easier to be Dick and Dee Dee, to accept that. And you have a hit record now, so what happens next after you have a hit record? You go on tour?
Well, then we started getting bookings to start traveling and singing. And we had never sung before in our lives. We knew no other songs together besides those two songs. So we tentatively took off for a tour of Texas in the summer. And basically the tour only had us do, I think, about four or five songs. We did a maybe 20-minute set in this particular tour. But when the tour was over, I came up against the situation of, do I go back to school or not? And I was ready to go back to college.
Well, you really weren't sure at that point if you wanted to continue singing.
Well, I wanted to. I really loved it. What I found from that tour was how much music meant to people and what an amazing thing it was to be. The part, everything else fell in the background when it came to actually performing. The actual singing, the actual being a part of musicians that are all playing at the same time as you're singing, and that you're putting this out there and people are responding, and it was something unlike anything I'd ever experienced, and it was such a beautiful experience that I loved that aspect of it, and I did want to continue with that. I was getting a lot of pressure from my family and my friends to get a college education, and I was being told, this is a fluke, it's never going to happen again, you're just wasting your time, you're going to spend a couple of years on the road, and then you'll be too old to go to college, and I was hearing all this. So I had to struggle with what to do, and I finally got some guidance. As I mentioned in Vinyl Highway, I talked to a monk who was very wise, and he thought that I should actually take advantage of this, that it would be an education unlike any other, which it definitely turned out to be.
When you were on the Texas tour, you were performing with some major performers at that time?
Let's see. Well, the tour was divided into two parts. On the first part, the headliner was Ray Peterson, and Dick and I and Kathy Young,
yes,
and also the Hollywood Argyles Band were the act on that particular segment. Second half of the tour, Ray Peterson left and Gary U.S. Bonds arrived as the headliner. But Kathy and her mother was my quote-unquote chaperone.
Right.
In those days, you had to have someone go with you as a chaperone. My mom asked her if she'd be my chaperone. So it was Gary U.S. Bonds and Dick and I and Kathy Young on the second half of the tour.
One of the things that I have to tell people about the book Vinyl Highway is it doesn't pull any punches. It tells things the way they were. And you had some incidents on the Texas tour that were not the most pleasant in the world, but you spell them out in the book. Could you relate one or two of those incidents for our listeners here?
So yeah, sure.
What was it like back then?
Dick and I were from California. The Hollywood Argyles Band was from California, and Kathy Young was from California. Gary U.S. Bonds and his two musicians, I don't know where the musicians were from, but Gary was from Florida. When Dick and I went on this tour, we didn't realize that we would be in a segregated state with an integrated tour. It just didn't dawn on us. We weren't raised with segregation, and so it was a non-issue with us. But when we first were there, and we first met Gary the very first day, we were standing on the sidewalk in front of our hotel, and the promoter had picked up Gary and his two musicians, Mel and Earl, at the airport, and we were in front of the hotel, and Dick mentioned that he hadn't eaten any breakfast, and the promoter was a little put out because he'd hoped to get on the road. But he looked at his gas tank and realized he needed gas, and he said, okay, go get something to eat, but you've only got half an hour. We've really got to get going to get to this show tonight. So we headed for a restaurant. We looked at Gary and his musicians and said, have you eaten? And they said, no. And we said, well, come on, let's go get some breakfast. So we went to the hotel dining room thinking it was the closest place and we could get served quickly. It was one of those places with chandeliers and linen cloths, and, you know, it was very nice. We went in and sat down, and we waited and waited, and they didn't come over to wait on us. And finally, a waiter did come over, and Dick said what he was going to order, and the waiter bent down and whispered to him, I can serve you, but I can't serve them. And we went, what? Like, why not? Like, we literally did not realize what this was all about. And then they whispered that they had a whites-only policy. I felt like someone had taken a bucket of water and poured it over my head. I was stunned, flabbergasted, shocked, and speechless. And Dick started getting angry, and he started saying, look, come on, we're singers, we've got to get on the road, we just need to eat, can we just get something? And the man just walked away, he wouldn't do it. So Gary and his musicians saw the embarrassing situation. By now everybody in the restaurant was looking, and he stood up and he said, it's all right, we're used to this, he said. I guess he, being from Florida, we had run into this, and he said, we'll be outside, and he started to leave, and Dick jumped up and said, we're going too. Well, in the meantime, Dick had tucked the corner of the tablecloth behind his belt. I walked out ahead of Dick. He let me go ahead of him, and as he followed, I heard this terrible crashing. I turned around, and the entire tablecloth was being dragged off the table, china, and the glassware, and the silverware.
Oh, my God.
And this giant crashing sound as it all hit the floor. And Dick went, oh, whoops, sorry, you know, in a funny little voice like Jerry Lewis. And then he took the tablecloth out from his waist, and then we went outside. And I was just like sleepwalking. I was so stunned. And the promoter was sitting there with a van. He's going, come on, come on, we got to get going. So we got in the van, and we started driving, and nobody said anything. It was like we're all just in shock. And then the promoter turned around, and he said, well, I hope you had a good breakfast, because we're so late now, we're not going to stop until we get to the show tonight for any food.
Well,
that was our introduction to this situation. Now, we continued on for quite a while on this tour, and we had a lot of incidents. I write about them all on Vinyl Highway. The ending incident, I don't want to go into it. It's kind of a long story, and it would take a lot of time, but the final incident culminated in our putting ourselves at risk in a way that we were almost had a very bad encounter.
Could have been not here anymore.
Yeah, well, yeah. And I must mention, this didn't only take place on this one tour. We also had an incident on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tour several years later when our bus broke down in the South.
Yeah.
This was a real issue at that time. Now, I guess on this Gary U.S. Bond tour, I guess people in small towns thought we were freedom riders. Freedom riders were college kids, both black and white kids, who went down on buses to peacefully sit in lunch rooms and at lunch counters and not leave when they were requested to because of segregation issues. And so that was happening at that time, and they thought we were freedom riders as well, I guess.
But you were simply singers on a tour.
Yes.
I'm glad you escaped that, but I guess it kind of left a mark, made you do a lot of thinking, probably made you think about what the real world was like then. You're singing all these wonderful songs, and yet the real world is what you experienced there.
I will say I was a different person. I had seen things that I would never have witnessed had I stayed at home, and my friends couldn't. I tried to tell them about it, but they couldn't really relate to it. It was something very personal. And I think I was definitely altered from that first experience in some way. From that point on, after I made the choice to continue with singing, we started going out on the road more. Our next tour was a Midwest tour of Jan and Dean.
Right.
Again, in a car, as we drove for a month in a car with Jan and Dean. Right. Hours and hours in this car. But this was around the time that we recorded our second song. Well, actually, it was our third. Dick and I never had two consecutive hits. We would have a hit and a miss, and a hit and a miss.
Yeah, I have to point out something. You have a unique distinction. This is absolutely amazing. Dick and Dee Dee had five national top 40 hits, Billboard Hot 100, and those five hits came respectively in the years 1961, 1962, 1963, 1964, and 1965. That is amazing. One top 40 hit per year. The only problem was they released more than one record per year.
We did. We did. And so the second record we released, they wanted another clone to The Mountains High. They wanted to repeat the success of the first record. And so our producers got a little excited there. They went a little bit overboard. They had this instrument that was a long wooden mallet with ridges in it, and they had a tool that you would scrape it along, and it sounded like a sick duck, you know, going, one of those. And they had that on the thing. The River Took My Baby. It was a song about someone drowning in the water. It was not a pleasant song.
Sounds like the Jody Reynolds record of Endless Sleep or Moody River by Pat Boone. I mean, records were.
And so Liberty Records pressed up, you know, X amount of copies and sent them all out thinking this was the next big hit. And then when all the returns came back, they actually got back more returns than they pressed up because the bootleggers also thought it was going to be a big hit, and they pressed up a lot of bootleg copies.
Oh, boy, that's an eye-opener when they send out X amount of copies and they get X plus 50 copies back.
Well, I think it was more than 50 back, but what it told them was, we're being bootlegged.
We're being bootlegged. Well, again.
Well, that's that, too.
Again, welcome to the real world.
Our producers sat us down and they said, you know, we really liked I Want Someone. That was your original approach. You did a ballad. You did it beautifully. Why not try another ballad? So Dick actually wrote by himself. He wrote Tell Me, which is a beautiful song. He did a gorgeous job on that one. And my favorite part of Tell Me was the plunking strings that Don Rocky wrote. It's really very beautiful.
That was Tell Me by Dick and Dee Dee, their second top 40 hit. I know I've heard that title, Tell Me. I think the Rolling Stones had a song called Tell Me at some point.
Yeah, it's been used, and also
the Exciters
had that song, Tell Them That, You're Never Gonna Leave.
That was the Exciters, yeah. Rolling Stones had Tell Me, You're Gonna...
If you Google that title, there's all kinds of songs called that.
True, and by the way, there is a Dick and Dee Dee Rolling Stones connection. We'll talk about that in a few moments from right now.
Yeah, we'll talk about that more around the Thou Shalt Not Steal days.
The Thou Shalt Not Steal days. We're going to get to that, but we'll just kind of follow the story. This show is archived on JerseyGirlsSing.com, our website, JerseyGirlsSing.com. So if you missed anything, you just go back and start the show from the very beginning and listen anytime you want. I'm Ronnie Allen, and it is such a thrill to be talking to Dee Dee Phelps of the duo of Dick and Dee Dee. We should just mention briefly here, and later on we'll go into further details about it, but Dick St. John is no longer with us. He passed away in, what year was it, Dee?
It was December 2003.
Okay. We'll talk about the circumstances toward the end of the show, but right now we're focusing on this particular memoir called Vinyl Highway, Singing as Dick and Dee Dee. By the way, this will take you maybe a couple of days to read. At least it's 330-something pages. It's really detailed, and as I say, most of all, it is honest, and it's very fascinating and interesting. There's not a dull page in this book, I can tell you that.
Thank you, Ronnie.
I had difficulty putting this down, but my wife was starting to call me late for dinner. And I had to put the book down for a few moments, but then I gulped down my food and I got back to it and I read the entire book, and it's just an amazing book. We just heard Tell Me, and as you said, Dee Dee, a beautiful song written by Dick St. John. I have seen his name listed as something else besides Dick St. John.
It was Gosting, G-O-S-T-I-N-G. That was his given name. And after they changed my name to Dee Dee, he decided to change his last name to be something a little more, I don't know why he did it, actually. He did it because he told me that he liked the name St. John. He liked Jill St. John, who was doing cookbooks or something at the time, and he liked that name a lot. He kept talking about how much he liked the name, and suddenly changed his last name to St. John.
Did he eventually write some sort of a cookbook or something, a cookbook-related book or something?
He did. I think in the 80s they came out.
In the 80s.
His wife Sandy came out with a cookbook.
Oh, it was his wife.
They did that together.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
The cookbook.
You are the first author that I've done an interview show with, so it's a pleasure
Great.
For that reason as well.
You know, Ronnie, I'd like to invite people to go on the Dick and Dee Dee website, which is dickanddeedee.com. It's dickanddeedee.com. And click on the link on the left. There's a video link. And click on the vintage videos. There's some really fun vintage videos on there.
Great. I'm glad you mentioned that. The cover of the book shows you and Dick on a motorcycle.
It does.
Is this something that you did as a pastime?
No. Actually, it was a commercial for Triumph Motorcycles. We did a commercial once, and as a reward for that, they gave us each a motorcycle. Now, neither one of us had ever driven a motorcycle in our lives, and we had to pick them up in Pasadena, which is about 45 minutes to an hour from where we were living. They gave us instructions in a parking lot. They got us each on these bikes, and they showed us how to start it and how to rev it up and make it go around in circles in this parking lot. And then they said, okay, well, we'll see you. And I said, wait a minute, you want me to get on the freeway with this motorcycle? You've got to be joking. So I convinced him to actually bring the motorcycle to my house, but Dick was going to ride his home. Nope. So he got on it, and he made it safely. I was happy to hear he got there in one piece.
Did he drive slow, or how did he do it?
I don't know what he did. He must have taken surface streets. I'm sure he didn't go on the freeway. It must have taken him forever.
Don't you need a motorcycle license to be able to drive a motorcycle?
Probably. I would imagine so.
Well, I guess he must have gotten one or had one or something.
Oh, I don't know. Ever getting a license.
Strange confessions here now.
But so the picture,
yeah.
It was floating around. This picture of us on the motorcycle, the cover designer of Vinyl Highway, the book, wanted a picture of Dick and I on the road somehow, whether it be on a bus or in a car. And I couldn't find a picture like that. Then I remembered that we had had a picture taken on a motorcycle. However, the picture had been taken for this commercial, and it was put on the sleeve of a 45 RPM record that was sent only to the Triumph dealers in America. It was not sent to radio stations. It wasn't one of our singles. It was just the commercial.
Right.
And it had this sleeve on it. So I told the cover designer, yeah, there's a great picture, you know, with Dick and I on a motorcycle, but I can't imagine even 200 copies were even printed up. How many dealers were in America in that time? I don't know. And I said, you know, how are we ever going to find one? He said, well, if you're able to find it, it can't be a copy. I've got to get the actual sleeve to make it come out all right. So that day, I went on eBay, and I typed in Dick and Dee Dee, and up popped that. So I couldn't believe it. I honestly felt it was a gift, that I was being given a gift.
It was fate.
This happened a number of times in writing this book. There'd be something that would seem an insurmountable
obstacle,
and it would come along just my way in a very miraculous way, and this was one of those things.
So that's the cover. It's a smiling Dick and Dee Dee on the motorcycle. And I'm Ronnie Allen talking with Dee Dee, who sounds like she's smiling through this.
I'm smiling. I'm having a great time.
Oh, I am too. This is so much fun. Tell Me was your second hit single, and your third hit single came in the year 1963. Another song, I believe, written by Dick, Young and in Love.
Yes, and again, as I mentioned earlier, we never had two hits in a row. So after Tell Me, we released another song, and it was not a hit. And then Dick and I wound up switching labels. We left Liberty and went to Warner Brothers Records, and they wanted us to do another ballad like Tell Me. And so Dick wrote Young and in Love, where Tell Me was about lost love. Young and in Love was about being young and in love.
Thank you.
Young and in Love by Dick and Dee Dee. I want to talk about a group that you worked with. They were pretty good musicians, but they could only play in the key of C. I would assume that these guys, as well-intentioned as they were, probably didn't get too far because they were only able to play in the key of C. Am I fibbing or what?
Yeah, well, Ronnie, you know that they became huge and are huge even to this day. That was the Beach Boys.
But in those days, they could only play in the key of C.
At least that's what Dennis told us. Now, I think that was true because we were booked with the Beach Boys to do high school assemblies around the Los Angeles area in the daytime. And the idea was to keep us in L.A. long enough for us to record our first album. So that's what we were doing. And we met with the Beach Boys, and they were going to be our backup band. Now, they had just released on their own little label their very first record. I think it was Surfing.
The first one was on a small label called Candix, and it was called Surfin'. That's before they...
Surfin', that's right. It was Surfin'.
And before they got to Capitol.
And I think if you listen to Surfin', it's probably a four-chord progression in the key of C, I'm guessing. But
right. Well, Dennis Wilson didn't have to worry about it because he's a drummer, so he
didn't, a drummer.
It didn't matter what key he played in.
Yeah, he was in high school, and we were all just right out of high school. So we went and we rehearsed with them, and we found out right away they only played in the key of C. Well, Dick and I, basically, our songs were much higher pitched. They were about...
So did you have to sing low?
We did, about five or six notes lower. So
the mountain's high.
Yeah, that's right. So we managed to, in addition to doing our songs in a very strange way, we also managed to do some other songs that weren't as rangy, that we kind of sing it. We worked it out. We pulled the show together, let's put it that way.
How much touring did you do with the Beach Boys?
Well, that initial time around, it was maybe 3 months of doing high school assemblies.
There's a very interesting chapter in this book that describes something that happened on November 22nd, 1963, you were scheduled to do a show, and where was the show scheduled to be? With the Beach Boys.
This is one of those shows in the high school during the day, a high school assembly.
Assembly.
It was going to be in a gymnasium. It was somewhere down in Orange County, which was about, somewhere maybe a 45-minute ride south of Los Angeles by car.
And what happened was, we all know the events of that day, JFK got shot. The principal of the high school found out about this. He knew about it, but he made an interesting decision, and maybe you can tell us what that decision was.
Well, we were still at home. I was at my house, and my mother had the TV on, and when I walked into the room, she had tears running down her face, and I was just shocked because I'd never seen her cry before. And I just said, "Mom, what's wrong?" And she said, "You know, the president's been shot." And, of course, we started watching it, and then eventually, you know, he passed away. And I called Dick, and we were just devastated. And I said, "Dick, maybe, you know, we should try to call the school and tell them, you know, we can't just not show up because we have a contract and they could sue us and so forth, but we have to at least connect with them." So we tried to call the school, and nobody was answering. We couldn't. So Dick said, "You know what we need to do? We need to go down there. We need to go down there and tell them in person. You know, see, we're here. We showed up, but obviously we're not going to sing today, and we'll reschedule." So that's what we did. We got in the car. We got on the San Diego Freeway. It's our major freeway here in Los Angeles, going south. 405 is called today. And we were heading down the freeway, and all of the cars turned on their headlights. It was sort of like being in a funeral procession. All the cars turned on their headlights, and they slowed to about 25 or 30 miles an hour, all going really slow, nobody looking at each other in the other cars, everybody just in shock. And we went that way, all really slowly, all the way down there. And we got down there, and we went in the principal's office, and he told us that the kids had not been informed that this had happened in high school. And that he said they'll find out soon enough when they go home, and he wanted us to go ahead and do the assembly.
Wow.
And we just couldn't.
He wasn't even going to make an announcement to let them know this happened?
And I said, "Well, what do you think they would think when they go home and find out?" He said, "Oh, they'll think you didn't know either." And I said, "But we know. You know, we said we do know, and we really are. You know, we're really very upset about this." Meanwhile, the Beach Boys were in the gymnasium. They were already setting up. I said, "What do the Beach Boys think?" He says, "Oh, they're upset." But he said, "I told them we have a contract," he kept saying. So finally, we told him that we were going to call the newspapers and tell them what this man was going to force us to do and so forth. And then he quickly saw the light of day when the idea of bad press coming down on his head.
So you postponed the show.
We did, yes.
You did it like a week later.
Yeah.
One of the acts that was very popular, when you were popular, was a duo called Paul and Paula. Did you ever work with them at all?
Oh, yeah, sure. They were Ray and Jill. It was Jill Jackson and Ray Hildebrand. And we met them on the Dick Clark Caravan of Stars tour. They were both from Texas, and Paul lasted a few days on the tour, and then all of a sudden he decided he was not going to sing anymore. He wanted to go back to school, and off he just took off.
And the act became known as Blank and Paula.
Yeah, right. So she was so sweet. She was wringing her hands going, what am I going to do? You know, she's from Texas, really cute. What am I going to do? I lost my Paul.
That is pretty appalling.
Yes.
Okay, sorry, folks. So I didn't... I will deny that I said
I've
that.
I've never heard anyone say that, and that's very funny.
And you probably will never hear that again. But actually, that presents a dilemma, and I have a funny feeling that Dick Clark knew exactly what he had to do.
He said to her, look, you know, we can still continue on here, and I will take Paul's part. And everyone got really quiet because they knew Dick didn't really sing, you know, what was this going to be like? But the song, Hey Paula... You know, it was kind of, you could sing, talk it. You know, he would say, hey, Paula, I want to marry you. Kind of talk, sing, you know. And then she'd sing, hey, Paula, I want to marry you too. So, you know, they got through it. And Joe would do two or three solo songs, and that was it. And it worked out for the tour very well.
Did any of the newspapers or magazines try to make you and Dick an item?
Oh, of course. I mean, here you have a couple. They thought we were either boyfriend, girlfriend, or married, or they thought that we were brother and sister. That was another one we got a lot. And actually, we were just working together. We had been boyfriend and girlfriend in junior high, and that did not work out too well, actually. I had long hair then, and one day we were in the eighth grade.
Yeah.
How crazy you are in the eighth grade. Dick came to my house once. He was looking at my hair, and he said, you know, short hair is really trendy right now. He said, Audrey Hepburn and all these different people have short hair. He said, let me trim your hair a little. I thought he meant a little, like maybe an inch or something, you know. I said, I can't find any scissors. He said, get some scissors. I said, I can't find any. He said, well, you must have something. So I found my mom had pinking shears. He said, these are perfect for what I have in mind.
Zip.
So he started cutting, snipping away, and then he started going fast, so I wouldn't stop. And then I'm looking at the floor, and I'm seeing piles of this. And when it was over, I looked in the mirror, and I said, oh, my gosh, because I look like a cactus.
Let's talk about a song called Turn Around. This became your fourth hit single. It came in the year 1964. And this song was co-written by Harry Belafonte.
Going back to our hit record, we had Young and in Love, and then we had another song that came out after that wasn't a hit.
Yeah, of course. That was your
trend. That was our pattern.
Yeah.
And so, they were saying, maybe it's time to switch your style. And we said, well, what's left? We've done rock and roll. We've done ballads. Now what? And so they said, well, what other music do you love? Well, Dick and I both happen to love gospel and folk music, both. We were doing some folk songs in our act. We were doing Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, which is sort of gospel folk. We really loved that. Then they said to Dick, you know, you've written a lot of songs, and this last one you wrote wasn't a hit. Why don't you try to open it up a little wider and see if there's something you could find that someone else wrote if you like it? Dick had that seed sort of planted in his mind, and one day he was watching TV, and a Kodak commercial came on, and they were playing the song Turnaround with the lyrics on it about growing old and so forth and capturing pictures before people get too old, children in it and everything. And Dick just said, well, I heard the most incredible song. I want to get a copy. So our publishers and our promoters found out who published it and got us a copy, and we loved it. And so we recorded it, and it turned out to be a hit for us. The interesting part about that one was when we were in the studio with that, this man that we'd never seen before in our lives walked in, and we knew all the musicians on the session, so we didn't know who he was. He walked up to the microphone. He didn't have an instrument with him, and he looked like he was going to be singing with us. And we're looking at the control booth, and they're all laughing in there. They thought this was really funny. I looked at Dick. We're both just shrugging, like, who's this person? And they said, meet so-and-so. He's a professional whistler. They didn't trust us to do it or Dick to do it. And Dick muttered, I can whistle. I can do a fine job. He was kind of put out. And they said, no, this guy's actually a professional whistler. He puckered his mouth, and he read the sheet music, and he whistled this beautiful beginning of Turnaround, and it's a professional whistler. However, when we did it live, Dick always whistled, and it sounded great to me, you know.
Life grows short, and man grows old. Summer's gone, and the wind turns cold. Young man going out of the
Dick and Dee Dee, and Dee Dee Phelps is on the phone. We're talking about her book called Vinyl Highway, which came out just this year. I want to mention a gentleman named Bill Lee, who is very important to you. He was the love of your life at one point. You mentioned him quite a bit during the book. He was also an agent. He created some well-known TV shows. Would you like to just say a little bit about Bill Lee?
Yeah, Bill was absolutely a remarkable person. He started out as our agent at William Morris. There's a very, very funny story about how we first met Bill. And Bill was just enamored with rock and roll, and he was the only one. William Morris was a very staid, traditional agency at that time with Barbara Streisand and club acts. They didn't even know what rock and roll was all about. And Bill would bring in these groups, and he had them rehearse in his office. And Bill would join in and run around the office. Bill was just really something. After he left being an agent, he worked for Dick Clark. Well, first he managed some groups. He managed the Kingsmen, Dick and I, Paul and Paula, and the Dovells for a few years, I believe. And then he went on to work for Dick Clark Productions for many years.
He created New Year's Rockin' Eve.
New Year's Rockin' Eve, American Music Awards, Chicago and the Rockies. That was a special with the group Chicago. Just a whole laundry list of shows for Dick Clark. Bill and I were married in 65, and we have a son together, Chris, and Bill passed away when he was 42.
You became friends with a well-known songwriter by the name of Sharon Sheely.
Oh, yes, Sharon.
Sharon wrote a few hit records, most notably Poor Little Fool, which was a number one hit by Ricky Nelson. Sharon Sheely led you to Shindig, right?
Yes, very few people know this. Sharon actually created the whole concept. She realized from being over in England, she'd met Jack Good, who was a producer of music television over there.
And they had a show similar to Shindig at that
point. They did. It was almost identical that Jack had produced, and she convinced Jack that America was ready for a show like this. Now, you have to remember, in those days, the only exposure a rock and roll artist had or top 40 artist had in this country was either Ed Sullivan, and to be on there, you had to be huge. We're talking Elvis and the Beatles, basically.
Or American Bandstand.
Yeah, so that was it. Often, but Dick and I would go places, and nobody knew what we were going to look like when we arrived. And we had some very interesting experiences, since they didn't know what we looked like. So when she convinced Jack Good that they were going to call the show, oh, they had a working title. I can't remember what it was.
But it wasn't Shindig, initially?
No, it was something else for a while. But anyway, they finally turned it into Shindig. She was married to Jimmy then, and Jimmy became the host.
Jimmy O'Neill.
Jimmy O'Neill became the host, and Sharon was married to him. And she told us, you know, I really want you and Dick to get on right away.
Did you actually go into a studio prior to your performance and record the song?
Yes. The early part of the week, we would go into a recording studio in Hollywood, and we would go in with the Shindogs band. And we would record our song all over again with the Shindogs band. And then we would record whatever songs we were going to sing on the show besides our own records, because on Shindig, you often sang other people's songs as well. It was sort of a medley thing, and you do a lot of different things.
Right.
So whatever you were going to do, you recorded it all with a Shindogs band. And then the day of the performance, they played that tape with you singing with the Shindogs band, but also the Shindogs were playing live and we were singing live on top of it, which created a very interesting stereo effect. An overdubbing effect.
Did it always sound like you were overdubbed?
No, it sounded like you were pretty much duplicating it exactly.
So in other words, it didn't sound like you were overdubbed, even though you technically were.
Yeah, because you were actually singing live with a live band, it had the spontaneity of a live performance that way.
Shindig was on for how many years?
A short time, maybe a year and a half.
Yeah, a lot of people thought that show was on longer. There was a competing show called Hullabaloo.
Yeah, that sort of took some of the sales out of it, and also... Yeah, then there was another show.
Where the Action Is came about.
Well, it was Action, actually, because it was on every afternoon. And actually, and Bill. Which
Bill, Bill actually had something to do with that.
He and Roz Ross put that one together,
And then Where the Action Is, Paul Revere and the Raiders and Steve Alamo and somebody who came from my hometown of Teaneck, New Jersey, Linda Scott.
They were great.
And you were on Where the Action Is a few times.
Yes, we were.
I understand that there was an incident where a band actually got mad at you. And they sabotaged your act.
They did, and it's the only time in all the years that ever happened. It was very, very bizarre. Dick was a little bent out of shape over something that night. Things weren't going well with the rehearsal. The guys didn't seem to be real motivated, and we had to rehearse a half hour before the show, and they weren't sounding very good, and so the energy wasn't real terrific between the band and us at that point. And so when we actually did the show, they purposely tuned their guitar and their bass flat, and so it sounded just absolutely hideous, and everyone thought, obviously, we were singing flat.
One of the things that's interesting when you'll read it in the book is Dick was not sure what was going on. He thought that Dee Dee was the problem. And it was only later, after that, that Dick realized it wasn't you. There were a few times that you mentioned in the book where if Dick wasn't happy with the way you were singing, he had a secret weapon, which is called pulling Dee Dee away from the mic.
Right, by the back of his breath. It wasn't that he was unhappy with how I was. He would be unhappy with something, and he wouldn't know what it was. Something would not be sounding right to him. Maybe the microphone sounded strange, or we weren't loud enough.
Yeah.
He thought,
and you were singing into the same microphone generally, right?
Yeah, right. So he didn't want me, because I was a harmony part. He didn't want me to overpower his lead voice.
His secret weapon was his arm.
Here we were.
It back, and he could make you louder and softer at will without you doing a thing. You could just sing at your normal voice, and he could just change
louder,
the volume.
Push me into the microphone, and softer he'd pull me back from the dress.
You know, there's stories about this, and there's stories about how you did the Murray the K show. You were doing 5 shows a day, starting at 10 in the morning.
Right.
You were kind of the prisoner backstage because you really were kind of stuck in that theater. You couldn't go out because all the fans were outside and they would pull your clothing off or your hair or whatever. But there is an escape that you had. You found out about a hole that was backstage, and people that knew about that hole could climb through and you could have a brief escape from the backstage thing. It's all in the book. I'm not going to tell them what the hole was or where it led to, but you got to read Vinyl Highway to find out. Is that fair to say? Did I describe it pretty good?
Yeah, that's a good thing to say, sure.
Yeah. I do want to mention 2 more things before we sign off. In the book, there is a chapter called An Era Ends, and it tells about your last recording session with Dick. That was the evening that you found out that Dick wanted to disband the act.
Things were winding down, and there's a lot more that precedes all that to get the complete picture.
How do people get the book?
They can get the book in any bookstore if they just walk in and ask for it. If it's not available, they'll order it. They can get it on Amazon.com, or they can get it through the Dick and Dee Dee site, which if they do that, then I send a nice signed autograph picture. I have some pictures of Dick signed before he passed away, and I sign it, and then we can autograph it personally that way.
That's great. So if you want to get a personalized copy, visit the website, www.dickanddeedee.com.
On the website, it leads to the blog now. I'm telling just what's going on right now with things, and I'm telling. When people email me with a request, like someone said, did you ever perform with Roy Orbison? Well, we did, but it wasn't in Vinyl Highway, so I put that story on the blog.
December of 2003, while you were on vacation in Pebble Beach, you found out that Dick St. John, your singing partner for so many years, had died in a hospital 10 days after falling from the roof of his home.
I always thought somehow in the back of my mind that someday we would get together And there's always was a Simon and Garfunkel song that I loved. It was called Old Friends, and the line was, "Old friends sit on a park bench like bookends." I just love that line.
Right.
And I thought of Dick and I as on two ends of a park bench, right, with nobody in the middle, just but we're apart. But we're looking at each other, and this is sort of what we did in the latter years because we lived in the same town. We would run into each other at the post office and the drugstore, and I kind of tiptoed around issues. It was sort of, we were very polite to each other, and it was, you would, if you were on a first date, like you're very cautious type thing. And
right.
I'd say, how's so-and-so? Have you ever heard from so-and-so lately? And we'd talk about all our old friends and that kind of a thing. So I always thought somehow we would sit on that park bench someday and talk about things, and it was a total shock, obviously, a complete and total shock, yeah. Especially since it was an accident, which, you know, accidents are basically preventable, so.
It was around the Christmas holiday, too.
Yeah.
Which had to make it even more difficult to comprehend.
His house is near mine. It's a very, very low roof. I'd known three people that have fallen heights, and all of them survived, but Dick fell wrong, and he went into a coma and never recovered. It was just horrible.
Dee Dee, let me just tell you, this has been a wonderful experience talking to you, traveling the vinyl highway. We're going to close with a song called Thou Shalt Not Steal. This was written by John D. Loudermilk. Thank you so much for taking the time and doing this show with me.
Oh, thank you, Ronnie. And you know, we've had a couple of preliminary talks before this show today, and I've enjoyed so much talking to you. It's been a real pleasure.
And let's close with this song, hit number 5 for Dick and Dee Dee. This is Shout. easy for her to say. What's the title of this song, Dee Dee?
Thou Shalt Not Steal.
Well, that's the show. I highly recommend the book Vinyl Highway. Visit the Dick and Dee Dee official website, which is www.dickanddeedee.com. That's DICKANDDEEDEE.com for more information about the book and other things related to their musical career. A couple of bonus tracks right now. Here's the one that was supposed to be their first hit. Didn't turn out that way. This is the one that Dee Dee really liked. She was a co-writer on this, along with Dick. Here's Dick and Dee Dee with I Want Someone. finally, in the book, she mentions that Dick and Dee Dee recorded over some tracks by the Rolling Stones. One of those recordings is this one. Here's Dick and Dee Dee with Blue Turns to Gray.